Committee on the Environment and Land Use. I use that word committee loosely since there's nobody here. But we're going to get started. And just a couple words to the audience. I am going to handle these bills in the order that they're listed on the schedule. So those that are here for Senate Bill 82, I expect we won't get to you until a half hour, 45 minutes or so. But we're going to go right down the list on the order. See, my committee size just doubled. So let's go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 457. Senator Mona Sanderson, please.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. I introduced this legislation on behalf of Scott Forrester. Scott, can you come on up here? And that is the sole reason why we have introduced this bill. That's all I need to say. And I'll
okay. Mr. Forrester?
Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson. Mr. Chairman, these 457 was as a result of, in part, my candidacy for the East Multnomah Saltwater Conservation District this past November, where I ran in an at-large position. The way it's set up is that to be able to run for the board for three of the five seats, you have to own 10 acres or manage 10 acres or more of land. And as you might imagine, in the populous county of Multnomah, not many folks are lucky enough to own 10 or more acres of land, and less manage the land. Usually it's managed by a property company, a development company, Port of Portland Metro. So the fact that you have in a democracy, in this little government called a Soil Water Conservation District, that three out of the five positions folks can only run for elective office if they own or manage 10 or more acres. That's like going back to the 1700s. It's where the fact that you can only participate in democracy if you have land. Now, my purpose of the bill is to strike the land requirement. I would also request that consideration be given to strike the management requirement so that any person that would otherwise be qualified to run for elective office, such as school board or water district, city council, should also be able to, no more, no less, be able to run for all of the seats of the Soil Water Conservation District. And what makes this more important, especially for East Multnomah, is that they just passed a property tax limit, basically the first time that this little district has had a tax in 54 years. And it was passed by, I believe, about over 140,000 people in Multnomah County voted for the property tax base to fund this district. But yet, out of the 300,000 people that reside within the district, only a handful of people are qualified to run for three of the five elective seats. So this is taxation without representation. You're going to tax businesses and residences, and literally over 100,000 people that may wish to run or know a neighbor that might wish to run for elective office cannot participate in democracy. And I think it's time this bill cleans up that particular provision. And also one additional thing, I checked with a couple attorneys that have knowledge of constitutional law, and as attorneys often have many opinions, it's their opinion that it's unconstitutional to allow people to not be able to vote based on whether or not they own or manage 10 or more acres. So I just want to have equality here, clean it up. And one other point is we put 250,000 as a number. It was a placeholder. I really only wanted to affect East Multnomah. The idea is maybe use it as an experiment area and see if the sky falls. If it doesn't, then perhaps other soil water conservation districts may choose to do that. Otherwise, if this bill is perhaps not passed in this legislative session, then I would try to push that we have a bill that would have all of the soil water conservation districts open instead of just the most populous ones. So I think this really addresses the areas that are highly urbanized, where in the upper 90% of the people aren't farmers, they're not folks that have orchards, and they're being taxed in many cases and yet are not able to participate. And one other point, the associates, which is a process whereby you can waive the requirement for the ownership or management of land if you serve at least 1 year. It's a highly politicized process, such that the existing boards only pick people that they're comfortable with from a political point of view, and those are the associates that get to serve because they're the only ones then that are otherwise able to run in lieu of not owning the land. And, of course, in a highly urbanized area, you don't get often a lot of people that are environmentalists or people that are perhaps a different political persuasion, and frankly, that needs to be taken out. You should be able to run for the political office, this nonpartisan office, based on your will and your ability to serve, and the citizens that are paying taxes should elect you and hold you accountable, and that's all I want to happen, is that this be treated like any other elective office.
Okay.
Any questions, Mr. Chair, or fellow members?
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? I just have a question, Mr. Forrester. I've got on the list here there's about 8 other people scheduled to sign up, and they're all against the bill. And do you want to anticipate what their testimony is, or do you want to loop around at the end and then respond?
I would appreciate that if I could comment after their comments.
Okay.
But
that'd be fine.
I will say that I think that it's either a really bad bill or it's a bill that's so terribly good that there's this unanimity of opposition.
Okay. Well, we'll hear that opposition then.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and have a seat. Paul Reed, Claire Clock, Ian Raines. Is it a really bad bill or a really good bill? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Reed. I'm here as a representative from East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District in Eugene. I'm going to read into testimony a letter that we have presented to staff for distribution to the committee, and we're here in opposition to SB 457. The Board of Directors of East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District are opposed to the passage of Senate Bill 457. The proposed modification to ORS 568-560, if passed, could have the effect of nullifying the primary thrust of Oregon's soil and water conservation districts in the districts affected by the revision. The primary thrust of soil and water conservation districts is, by statute, to cooperate with landowners, land occupiers, other natural resource users, other governmental units, and with agencies of the government of this state and the United States in projects, programs, and activities calculated to advance the policies, and that's a quotation from the statute, of natural resource conservation, control and prevention of soil erosion, and to develop water resources and improve water quality. One of the primary policy directives that soil and water conservation districts implement at local levels towards the achievement of a legislative policy is the Agricultural Water Quality Management Act of 1993, commonly known as Senate Bill 1010. That brings the directors and staff of soil and water conservation districts into direct contact with those who conduct agricultural activities in Oregon. That level of contact and understanding of the challenges facing agriculture is the primary reason that the qualifications for SWCD zone director positions was established by ORS 568-560. A closer connection to those we serve can be made by ensuring that those familiar with agricultural practices through the ownership and or management of at least 10 acres of land can guide the staff of SWCDs as zone directors. Removing the land ownership requirements for zone director positions would open the door for individuals with no understanding of the primary mission of soil and water conservation districts and the processes involved in agriculture to hold positions affecting agriculture. There already exists opportunities for persons who do not meet the 10-acre requirement to serve on soil and water conservation district boards. In districts with a population that is defined in SB 457, there would usually be 7 director positions. In East Multnomah, there happens to be only 5. If there were 7 director positions, there would be 2 at-large positions, or with 5, there would be 1 at-large position, where the sole qualification is that the person must reside in the district and be a registered voter. That's a quote from the statute. There's also another method already stipulated in 568-560 where a person without the 10-acre qualifications could seek appointment to the Board of the Soil and Water Conservation District. That requirement is laid out. It is our understanding that SB 457 was thought to have been constructed so narrowly that it would affect only Multnomah County. A review of the 2000 census reveals, however, that it would also affect Clackamas, Washington, Marion, and Lane counties. The proposed language would also generate a standard that would be quite difficult to objectively establish, since Multnomah and Lane counties have two soil and water conservation districts, but the census data represents the full county in each case. How would you determine whether your district actually has a verifiable population of 250,000 or more? SB 457 would also establish poor and possibly unconstitutional public policy by establishing different qualification standards for the same position in a government body of the state. The Board of Directors of East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District urge you to recommend a do not pass when forwarding this bad bill to the full body for deliberation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm just going to ask the rest of you sitting up here, and also the folks who are going to testify on this, to try not to rehash the same arguments, just because we have a lot of people signed up, and I have a feeling that a lot of the arguments are going to be the same. So just in the interest of moving along. But go ahead, sir.
Yes. Good point. My name is Claire Clock, and I live in East Multnomah County, one of the affected districts. My wife, Beverly, and I have small acreage and some timberland in the county. Just two points that I want to emphasize. You can read the rest in my written comments. But basically, the at-large positions with no acreage restrictions do allow anyone in the county to represent the county. The purpose of the Soil and Water Conservation District has traditionally been for full-time farmers in developing best management practices for research concerns on their property. That farming community has changed to include a large amount of small acreage landowners like myself. We've been farming for 25 years and know how well the Soil and Water Conservation Districts have served the community. We need to have people on the board that manage 10 acres or more and understand the problems that we face to really make the districts really effective. And that's it. Any questions?
Thank you. Well, we'll save the questions for the whole panel.
Okay. My name is Ian Rains. I'm the district administrator for the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, which includes all of Multnomah County east of the Willamette River. You have today's testimony and a letter that our board of directors have written to Senator Lori Moniz Anderson and Representative John Lim with a CC to this committee. So you have those, and you also have our associate director guidelines. The board of directors have asked me to have their letter put into testimony. I can read that for you, or if you want, you'll have a copy, so you can read that. And there are additional copies in the back of the room.
May I just ask a question?
Sure.
The proponent of the bill suggested that maybe there was something different about East Multnomah County, given that it was more urbanized than other parts of the state, and so that's why there was the 250,000 figure. I mean, is there some sense in there that we don't live in a one-size-fits-all and we ought to have maybe a different rule in areas that are urbanized?
Well, we do provide technical assistance and educational information to our urban constituents, renters, homeowners, small acreage landowners, and our rural and agricultural producer constituents. And I agree with what Claire said about having a farming background or a natural resources management background, whether you're a manager of a golf course or a park, could be a valuable type of experience for the board to be able to meet those needs of the agricultural and rural constituents. Let me tell you a story about our district that's included in this testimony here. It's described in the letter that a person does not have to own or manage 10 acres of land to become a zone director. To be an at-large director, basically you just have to be a registered voter and live someplace in the district. And our district has two at-large positions and three zone positions. The zones are divvied up geographically according to rivers and baselines and that kind of thing. Any voter can be elected to an at-large seat, and after 1 year, that at-large director would be eligible for a zone seat if he or she lives in the zone. A person may also be declared eligible for an at-large seat or a zone seat, either one, if they've served as an associate director for at least a year. In the past 12 years, the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District has had three people who've been appointed to associate director positions by the voting members of the board who later became directors. And an associate director is a member of the board, but they're not a voting member. They're not elected by the general electorate. They're appointed by the board to fulfill needs that the district has and that kind of thing. We've had three people who become appointed to associate director positions who later became directors. Two of them became at-large directors and one became a zone director. There have also been four at-large directors who become zone directors, and one of those started out originally as an associate director. So you can be nominated and serve as an associate director. Within a year, you can be eligible to serve as either a zone or an at-large, and we've had that happen in our district.
We've got your written testimony here.
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
One of the things that I find right now, at least with East Multnomah, is it's overrepresented in the urban area as far as the directors themselves. And that's my main concern, is that that other districts besides ours will become more highly urbanized board and not see the agricultural interest.
Okay. Thank you. Let's let her finish up. Okay. Go ahead. Just another couple of seconds.
So you have copies of our associate director guidelines and the selection process. There's an application process that we use to select associate directors. It's not a process by which the board selects its political friends. It selects people based on their qualifications, their skills, their willingness to serve the district, and it outlines what kinds of needs the district has and what kinds of qualifications the person brings when they ask to become an associate director.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I can't speak for East Multnomah because I'm a resident of Lane County, but in our district, in East Lane Soil and Water Conservation District, there are five zone positions and two at-large positions. The division of the zones in Lane County fairly evenly distributes the urban population across all the zones. I myself am an at-large director. I'm also the secretary treasurer of the district. So the implication that there would be unequal representation of the urban population on the board is a fallacy.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Sir, your name was it Mr. Bedell? Is it?
Well, that's Paul Reed.
Okay, that's Paul Reed. Okay, then Mr. Bedell, I'm sorry. And John McDonald and Doug, is it Cromer?
Kramer.
Sorry about that.
You want all of us?
Sure. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chairman Ringo and committee members, my name's Tom Bedell. I'm going to try to paraphrase this a little bit, but it's only back in two sides of a piece of paper.
Okay.
But for the record, my name's Tom Bedell. I'm an elected director with the Benton Soil and Water Conservation District, and I'm chair of the Soil and Water Conservation Commission. Now, the commission, I want to give just a little bit of history here. The commission's an advisory body to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, formed under ORS Chapter 561, and consists of seven conservation district director positions representing geographic areas of the state. The director of the Department of Agriculture appoints the commission members, and its function is to advise the department on matters relating to soil and water conservation districts, conservation programs, and natural resource issues. As chair of the commission, I also serve as a member of the State Board of Agriculture and represent districts as the board considers and discusses natural resource issues such as the Ag Water Quality Management Plan or Program, commonly referred to as Senate Bill 1010. And I'm here today to communicate the position of both the commission and the Board of Agriculture on Senate Bill 457. The commission reviewed 457 at its last meeting about a month ago and voted unanimously to oppose the bill. The Board of Agriculture reviewed the bill at its meeting just a week ago, less than a week ago, and passed a resolution to oppose the bill as well. And for these are the following reasons.
If you could just summarize it here.
Okay.
We've got it right here.
One of the primary reasons is it turns out to be geographic representation within a district and hands-on activities on the land. If one's going to be affected by various policies, soil and water conservation district policies or various regulations, we ought to have input from people who are actually going to be affected by it, and it's more likely that people that live and work on the land can speak for those positions than someone lives in town. It doesn't necessarily say it's always going to happen, but it's more likely. And the second part here has already been stated by the previous panel, and it's in this testimony here, that there's several different ways to become a zone director, and you can read those as well. That's all in statute that exists right now. Another concern that we have is that the bill as written doesn't only apply to the one district that it came from, but it will apply to several others, which will be addressed by other people here. And so we think that that this bill at this time, at least, should not be passed, and that we ought to, if we want to give it consideration, we ought to have a broader consideration than just this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Kramer?
I'm Doug Kramer. I'm chairman of the Marion Soil and Water Conservation District, and I'm also a member of the Soil and Water Conservation Commission. I am a farmer in St. Paul, Oregon, and I strongly oppose Senate Bill 457 because I believe, in my experience with soil and water conservation districts, that the landowner provisions of zone directors give those soil and water conservation district boards a feel for the land that non-landowners have a tough time bringing to that board. Our Marion District, both our at-large positions are held by urban people, and so we believe they're an important part of the process, but our zone directors are all landowners, which bring that when we're doing our planning, implementation, and managing of conservation practices, it's very important to that board to have that experience.
Hi, Mr. Kramer, I guess my question I have is, do you think it makes sense that maybe there's a different rule for East Multnomah County?
I don't, because I think in the end, conservation practices are being implemented on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They're being implemented on pieces of property that are either publicly or privately held, and we need to have people with experience on that land to be in those board positions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. McDonald.
My name is John McDonald. I'm a resident of Hillsboro, Oregon, hazelnut grower, chairman of the Tualatin Soil Water Conservation District, which is Washington County, and also executive director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. To honor your request, Chair Ringel, I'm going to allude to the two pages that have been distributed to you. I've gone over the items that have already been covered about how you get to be one. I'm obviously completely convinced that it is a fair operation. I might also add that there are other special districts that do have restrictions on who can be members of their boards based upon needing certain kinds of qualifications to effectively operate. This is not alone a provision of soil and water conservation districts. In fact, our having at-large positions even goes beyond some of the practices of other areas. I will call your attention to just the
another minute, please.
To call your attention to the information on the back and add one point that has not been made yet. We have five core functions. It says, you know, identify resource concerns and strategies and so forth. I call your attention to items 4 and 5 in that paragraph. Provide technical assistance to landowners and land managers, and advocate the landowners to get the technical assistance and the financial assistance to implement the programs that they need to do on their properties. The operative words are land managers. Our consumer base are primarily land managers. Yes, we have a responsibility to, you know, citizens throughout our districts for education, outreach, and technical assistance, but primarily, if we're going to affect any changes, you know, the things about, you know, going to affect water quality, et cetera, it's going to happen on the land. So our consumers are, you know, people who are landowners, whether they're agriculture, ranchers, foresters, small acreages and so forth, and therefore having that experience builds two things. One is a certain knowledge about the kinds of things that are possible and can be done on the land, and the second thing it gives me as a landowner and a director is a building relationship and rapport to get beyond the kind of mistrust and some of the fear of government and so forth that a lot of our landowners have. And therefore, we have a better access to those people who are most likely to make the changes necessary.
Okay. Thank you very much. Committee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your coming here today. Good luck with those hazelnuts. Rick, is it Grun and Katie Fast? And we could wrap it up with the last word pretty quickly. Then we're going to go back to Scott Forrester for the strong rebuttal and move off this. Go ahead.
For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, and we also are in opposition of Senate Bill 457. A big piece of Soil and Water Conservation District's success is their trust and communication with landowners. And that trust comes from the ability to have farmers and landowners as the board of directors. We are in a time right now when there is a lack of trust in government with landowners and within the agricultural community. And SWCDs are able to work cooperatively with landowners. They are invited to have their staff come to farms and work on difficult issues like water quality and other environmental challenges. And that's due to the direction. And they also give a direction of communication and how to work with landowners and discuss difficult issues with them that we feel that an urban representation probably wouldn't offer as much. And just quickly, I'd like to also address the issue of high-density areas. East Multnomah County has a vibrant agriculture community as well, and the farmers out there are facing unique challenges in that high-density area that other areas don't face. And I think it's important to still have that landowner representation from people who are facing different issues than a more rural setting are, and the farmers in those areas can bring that as well. And I think you've heard that currently the system doesn't take away volunteer opportunities from urban residents in the districts. I think they welcome those. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you
very much. Mr. Grun?
Thank you, Senators. My name is Rick Grew, and I'm District Manager for Clackamas County Soil and Water Conservation District. And I thought I'd give you a little bit of a different perspective on what you've heard today. On behalf of my board, we're here in opposition of SB 457. Clackamas County, you talk about urbanization. I want to give you a couple of facts. We're the third largest in population. We're the second largest in gross farm gate sales. We're first in the number of Christmas tree production. We're first in greenhouse and nursery production in the state, and we're ninth in the nation in number of horses. These all represent a great unique opportunity for both large and small landowners to take part in agriculture. As a whole, our Clackamas County commissioners have identified ag and natural resources as one of our four major traded sectors in Clackamas County. Representation by our local elected Board of Soil and Water Conservation Districts with the working knowledge of ag and natural resources provide the opportunities to give local solutions to local resource concerns.
Mr. Grun, I'm sorry, just one more minute, okay?
Absolutely, I'll finish up right now.
A lot to cover today.
Sure. My final point is that whether you're a small landowner, large landowner, live in an urban area or in the rural area, that you are taking part in ag and natural resource-based opportunities, the same type of technical assistance is needing to be given by the board and staff of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Thank you very much. On behalf of our board, again, we urge you to consider, and thank you for your interest in soil and water.
Thank you very much. Committee? All right. Thank you. Mr. Forrester, come up for the one-minute rebuttal, and then we'll move on to the next bill.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, fellow committee members. This is not against soil water conservation districts. I ran for office in November. I got 65,000 votes. I lost by 9,000. Okay, I was for the mission. That's why I ran. I see this as being a modern approach for the highly urbanized districts to have buy-in by the citizenry. Again, East Multnomah passed for the first time in its 54-year existence a tax measure of 10 cents per 1,000. That means I'll be paying $15 a year, but I cannot run for office, nor anyone can vote for me. Tens of thousands of urban people that also create soil erosion and water pollution. We care just as much about the rivers and the land as anyone else. We need to have representation. As note to Clackamas County, I helped to establish the Clackamas River Basin Council, a member of the Friends of the Clackamas River, a 501c3 nonprofit, on the board for 10 years. I used to sit across from small woodlot owners, people that were in the agriculture industry, the Forest Service. I know about talking across the aisle. This is not an attack on saltwater conservation districts. In fact, I think the modern approach is that if saltwater conservation districts have faith in the people, especially when they're increasingly asking for tax bases so that they're not dependent on grants so they can fund these wonderful programs, the faith has to be based in those that pay taxes have to be able to engage in the democratic process. And so that's what it's really all about. And I think there is room for discussion. And it's my first bill, and I apologize for not getting in contact with all these folks here behind me that are in opposition. But I really think that if it doesn't go through this legislature, then there might be opportunities perhaps to pass this bill, but without East Multnomah. If that's the solution, if we're afraid of unconstitutionality, then let's have this apply to every saltwater conservation district in the state. And I think that actually might be the constitutional solution.
Well, Mr. Forrester, I appreciate your coming, and you don't need to apologize for not coordinating it or doing anything. I think you've done very, very well. Son, I appreciate your coming here today. Are there questions from the committee?
Yes,
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said you don't have an opportunity to participate in democracy, but yet you said you just ran for election and lost. So there is an opportunity for you to do that, correct?
Sure. I ran as an at-large position, but the fact is that in East Multnomah there are 5 seats and only 2 are at-large. 3 are basically held by a clique of persons that use political power to only anoint the associates that can thereby waive a 10-acre requirement. It's a system that's been abused. You heard testimony that said in the last 12 years they've had 3 people that have gone to zone seats because nobody owns or manages 10 acres. It is woefully inadequate. Some saltwater conservation districts has dozens of people that serve as associates, but East has so few people with that requirement they can't even serve. And one other point, this last election, while I was running for the at-large seat because that one doesn't have a land requirement and it was the only one I was allowed to run for, Zone 2, which I also reside in the city of Gresham, I couldn't run for that seat because I didn't own or manage 10 acres, and no one ran for it. It was on the ballot blank, blank, and 2 people ran pretty good campaigns for write-ins, and both of those people, including the winner declared by the Oregon Department of Agriculture, could not qualify for the seat even though they won in a write-in campaign because, of course, they didn't own or manage 10 acres. This is a system that isn't working, and despite all the testimony to the contrary about how good it can be for the highly urbanized areas, it is not working. And frankly, if saltwater conservation districts don't get with the program and invite the urban folks that care just as much about our land and water and have them come into the fold so we can create a dialogue between urban and rural, this is a wonderful opportunity to create that by having that in the electoral process.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Beyer, anything else?
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Mr. Forrester, I was just going to make a couple comments.
Yep.
Sometimes it's helpful to have written testimony, and I invite you to prepare something and send it to my committee staff, Matt Shields, just kind of outlining your arguments.
I actually have it, and okay. I didn't bring a hard copy. I understand now that I need 20 pages. If you could keep the record open until tomorrow, I'd be glad to submit it.
I'd be happy to do that. And if you send it to him, we'll distribute it to the committee members.
And if your staff has the other contacts, I'd be glad to CC a copy to everyone that made a presentation here.
The other thing I was going to suggest to you is if it makes sense to draft this bill so that it only addresses East Multnomah County, if that truly is a special case in your mind, you might consider what amendments can be made so it could operate in that fashion. Okay?
Just to answer your question, the reason why I thought East might be the best idea was because I thought it would upset less people politically.
Okay.
And I guess that didn't work. So, frankly, I think the solution is perhaps all or nothing.
Well,
or maybe highly urbanized areas.
I think you were on the right track. You might want to narrow it a little more, okay? Thank you very much, Mr. Forrester. Let's close the...
the hearing on Senate Bill 457 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 542. Senator Gordley, I apologize for making you wait. Okay, good. Good. And feel, Senator Gordley, feel free to organize the witnesses any way you prefer.
Good afternoon, Chair Ringo and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Avell Gordley, and I represent the central east side of Portland, northeast and southeast Portland. I am here to offer some background information on Senate Bill 542, which creates an environmental justice task force. And there are three good people with me who will introduce themselves and provide testimony in support of this legislation. At the outset, Mr. Chair, I would have to say to you that we have been waiting. I have been waiting as a participant in this process for over 10 years to get a hearing on this public policy concept. And it's a great day just to be sitting here to talk about these issues with you. Senate Bill 542 creates a task force to achieve and maintain environmental justice in the state of Oregon. What is environmental justice? It is the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of people of all colors, national origins, cultures, income levels, ages, gender, and education and geography in the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. And you'll hear more about the impacts of what that means from the good people joined with me. This task force will be charged with addressing serious problems first identified in Oregon more than 10 years ago and identified nationally more than 20 years ago. The problem is environmental discrimination, which has been defined as any policy or practice that generates environmental impacts for groups or communities that are identifiable by race, color, national origin, or economic background. This discrimination includes both the lesser enforcement of environmental standards and any practices that limit participation in decision-making by these groups or communities. The Environmental Protection Agency concluded in a 1992 report that racial and ethnic minorities were disproportionately subjected to exposures to air pollutants, hazardous waste facilities, contaminated fish, and agricultural pesticides, and that African American children were disproportionately subject to high blood levels and to the accompanying adverse health effects. At that time, a National Law Journal investigation also found racial disparities in the enforcement of federal environmental laws. Numerous studies found evidence that pollution-generating facilities tended to be disproportionately cited in low-income and working-class communities and communities experiencing a population shift from one ethnic group to another. The cleanup of contaminated properties also raises several environmental justice issues. The divestment and blight that accompanies areas with more than their share of contaminated sites leaves people of color and poor persons who live nearby in a difficult situation. The first problem is that these areas have to compete with other contaminated sites for government cleanup resources. These sites are often neglected or receive less effective cleanups than sites in wealthier, predominantly white areas. State brownfield programs vary widely in the degree of community involvement and cleanup. Moreover, because brownfield redevelopment projects often allow less stringent cleanup standards in light of anticipated industrial reuse, they have a tendency to lock in the legacy of industrial development in areas where people of color and poor persons live. Although there is typically a serious attempt to control the exposure to remaining hazardous waste through physical means, such as capping, and through legal means, such as deed restrictions, surrounding communities are left with the risk that these controls will fail. Relocation of residents living near more contaminated sites or polluting factories raises its own set of environmental justice issues, largely due to the fracturing of existing community bonds and the inability of individual residents to secure comparable housing at the prices offered under the terms of the relocation. Too often, residents are offered the fair market value of the home located in the hazardous area, an amount sharply deflated precisely because of the environmental risks, and therefore not enough to buy a comparable dwelling in a safer neighborhood. The relocation process itself can consume an enormous amount of the community's time and resources. Finally, there is the issue of public participation. Environmental decision makers traditionally have heard the views of industry giants, conventional environmental organizations, state and local governments, and federal land managers, but not the people who actually live in the most affected areas. The first organized effort, Mr. Chair, to investigate environmental discrimination in Oregon was made by the Oregon Environmental Equity Citizen Advisory Committee in a report to the governor in October 1994. The committee was established by the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality at the request of then Governor Barbara Roberts. Governor Roberts' request was made at the request of my office when I was serving in the House of Representatives. At the time, DEQ and the Oregon Health Division were engaged in an examination of how minority and low-income groups were disproportionately affected by environmental hazards. The purpose of the Citizen Advisory Committee was to assist DEQ and the Oregon Health Division to identify environmental equity issues, to examine the concerns of minority and low-income communities, and to propose an interagency approach to assure equity in state regulatory decisions concerning the environment. Environmental equity refers to equal protection from environmental hazards. It signifies fairness in the development and enforcement of environmental laws so that benefits are enjoyed and risks are borne equally by all citizens. The Environmental Equity Citizen Advisory Committee developed 29 recommendations in 6 issue areas. 1. Practices of natural resource agencies dealing with public participation and communication to the public. 2. Exposure to water pollution. 3. Farm worker exposure to pesticides. 4. Exposure to household pollutants. 5. Land uses, siting of facilities. And 6. Cleanup of contaminated sites. In 1997, Governor Kitzhaber established the Oregon Environmental Justice Citizen Advisory Board. The board had 12 members representing minority and low-income communities, environmental interests, and the geographical areas of the state. The board was later increased to 14 members with the addition of representatives of affected industries. The life of the board, unfortunately, extended only from August 1997 to July 1999. The major task of the Oregon Environmental Justice Advisory Board was to evaluate the progress that state agencies had made in implementing the recommendations of the 1994 Citizen Advisory Committee. The major finding of the advisory board was that most state agencies had made little progress to implement the recommendations contained in the 1994 report to the governor. Their conclusion was that the majority of agencies had not evaluated their agency goals, decisions, or enforcement actions in light of the issues raised by the 1994 Citizen Advisory Committee. In addition, few, if any, of the state agencies had made progress on the major recommendation of the 1994 Citizen Advisory Committee, which was to adopt policies that incorporate environmental equity into the agency's institutional framework. In the board's view, these agencies seem to be unwilling to examine their own actions, with the exception, Mr. Chair, of DEQ and the Oregon Health Division. The Oregon Environmental Justice Citizen Advisory Board set forth four components of environmental justice: equal protection through consistent application and enforcement of laws, the elimination of environmental disparities, equitable access to resources broadly defined, citizen empowerment through procedural access. To make these components a reality in Oregon, the Oregon Environmental Justice Citizen Advisory Board, in their 1998 annual report, contained several recommendations for action by the governor. And by this time, we're talking about Governor Kitzhaber. Create a timeline for agency action on the 1994 recommendations. Encourage partnerships by local communities, businesses, and agencies. Examine existing data on environmental pollution and regulation and on race, national origin, and income to determine if patterns of bias exist. Make cumulative health impacts an important factor in environmental decision making. Encourage agencies to schedule meetings and hearings in the evening and provide child care. Increase agency efforts at public involvement in rural areas. Create a citizen advocate position in each natural resource agency. In addition, Mr. Chair, the 1998 annual report noted severe constraints on funding for the Oregon Environmental Justice Citizen Advisory Board's activities. The 1997-98 emergency board did not allow the advisory board to accept two grants that were awarded to it, and the 1999 legislature did not allocate funds for the board's work. Senate Bill 542 establishes the Environmental Justice Task Force, consisting of 12 members appointed by the governor. The members shall be persons who are well informed on the principles of environmental justice and who, to the greatest extent practicable, represent minority communities, low-income communities, environmental interests, industry groups, and geographically diverse areas of the state. And of the 12 members, the governor shall appoint one member of the task force from each of the following commissions: the Commission on Asian Affairs, Black Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, and the Indian Commission. The bill calls for the task force to submit an annual report to the governor setting forth its view on the progress of natural resource agencies toward achieving the goals laid out in the act defined in the bill. The bill also directs the Oregon's natural resource agencies to assist the task force in the performance of its duties and establishes the following scope of work. The Environmental Justice Task Force shall, and I'm moving to conclusion, Mr. Chair, advise the governor on environmental justice issues, advise natural resource agencies on environmental justice issues, including community concerns and public participation processes, identify in cooperation with natural resource agencies, minority and low-income communities that may be affected by environmental decisions made by the agencies, meet with environmental justice communities and make recommendations to the governor regarding concerns raised by these communities, and define environmental justice issues in the state. Chair Ringo and members of the committee, in order to provide greater public participation and to ensure that all persons affected by decisions of the natural resource agencies have a voice in those decisions, Senate Bill 542 directs each Oregon Natural Resource Agency to consider the effects of their action on environmental justice issues in the course of making a determination on whether and how to act, that these agencies hold hearings at times and in locations that are convenient for people in the communities that will be affected by the decisions stemming from the hearings, that there be engagement in public outreach to communities affected by decisions of the agency, that there be created a citizen advocate position that is responsible for encouraging public participation and ensuring that the agencies consider environmental justice issues. Senate Bill 542 further directs that all directors of natural resource agencies and other agency directors, as the governor may designate, shall report annually to the Environmental Justice Task Force and to the governor on the results of the agency's efforts to do four things: address environmental justice issues, increase public participation of individuals and communities affected by the agency's decisions, determine the effect of the agency's decisions on traditionally underrepresented communities, and improve plans to further the progress of the environmental justice in Oregon. Chair Ringo and members of the committee, in closing, and I do appreciate your attention to my remarks, I want to note that this bill is the result of more than a decade of work and study by citizens and interested parties from throughout the state, and those, including those who are seated here with me. Good people, good citizens who have identified the need for this task force. I ask you to send this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And again, I thank you for the time this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay. I had one question, Senator Cordley. I assume this has a fiscal attached to it, and my committee staff has said we don't have it back yet. Do you have any idea what it's supposed to be? Yeah, I think we have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
I do not, but I would say this, Mr. Chair. In light of the budget environment that we are in, it would be my hope that at the very least, we put into statute the policy, and consider the funding question later. But let's put the policy in place. After 10 years, I think it's about time.
Okay.
And there are many people in communities around the state who would be willing to work with the Natural Resource Agency's name to help move this work forward.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Shields.
Senator Gordley, I've tried to fight my way out of that box before, putting an idea forward and worrying about the financing later. How do we do that with an establishment, the legislature, always wanting to send everything to Ways and Means? I want to do that. I'm just wondering, how can we get there from here? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, what I know about this process is that there are very creative, thoughtful people engaged in both chambers and in both parties. And if we apply our will to get done what we want to get done, we find our way. So it is my hope that we will find our way, and I'm asking for your help to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
With your permission, Mr. Sure. Chair and Senator Shields, my name is Robin Morris Collin. I worked as a co-principal on the grant that financed the 1999 effort on behalf, and I would like to make a brief attempt to respond. At that time, we were able to secure a $20,000 grant from the Environmental Protection Agency through their small grant program. And that grant was administered by myself, Robin Morris Collin, my spouse who's sitting to my right and was a member of the actual board. The $20,000 was not a very, very large amount, as you may know, but that was fairly commonly given. The lion's share of that, approximately 26% of that amount, went to paying overhead indirect costs to the University of Oregon, which was the only way in which we could accept funds given the emergency emergency board's refusal to allow us to accept a much larger grant. I would say based upon that experience, we have been able to rely upon the good faith and the generosity, extraordinary personal generosity, of many people in affected communities who were willing to serve without compensation, without reimbursement. I wouldn't want to ask people to continue to make those kinds of sacrifices, but my personal experience is that we were able to come up with a very important and professional document and set of studies based upon that very small amount of money.
Maybe I'm asking you to speculate, and it may be unfair to do so, but why did the emergency board decline a much larger grant when the subject is environmental justice?
You are asking me to speculate, but at your invitation, if I may. We had a grant that was in the neighborhood of $200,000. And that amount of money would have significantly provided a range of services and in-depth of study that was really an opportunity we looked forward to and embraced. I believe that in large part, because that money came from a federal agency with whom there were insignificant control mechanisms or ties or political control mechanisms, perhaps people felt uncomfortable with that kind of money coming in for, exactly as you say, environmental justice. But that would be my speculation. And I'd like to introduce the other members who are here to testify today, if I may. I, as I mentioned, had the responsibilities in part for some of the financial issues. The gentleman to my right is Professor Robert Collin, who is currently a senior scholar at the Willamette University Center for Public Policy and an adjunct law professor at Willamette University. And the lady to my far right is Jerry Sunvall, who currently directs the Environmental Justice Action Group, which is the largest community-based environmental organization in the state and the most experienced in terms of environmental justice issues. With that, if I may, I'd like to turn it over to these two
panelists. Please do. I'll be short because the senator said everything I was going to.
Okay.
My name is Robert Collin. As introduced, I was the first EJ representative on a federal advisory committee, wrote the first law review article, taught it for 14 years. I was appointed to the FACA under Clinton and Bush, two different administrations, and have done this for a while. I wrote Wisconsin's statute 2 years ago with Dr. Veronica Edie out of Tufts. This is a good bill. It's nice and tight. Our experience before was very difficult. We drove all over the state, as you must yourselves, and had hearings all over and heard from the citizens. We couldn't offer child care. We couldn't always get the room we wanted down at Rowe Community College and so forth. We did what we could, and we called it stone soup. And I think you know what that is. And so the concern was great, and the members from the community that became involved had engaging, proactive, constructive ideas. When we first formed this in Kitzhoffer's office, some interest groups did not want to include industry. Environmental justice advocates, myself in particular, fought tooth and nail to include industry. And we had Terry Witt appointed from Oregonians for Food and Shelter because we work in a collaborative, problem-solving, non-litigative fashion. The report speaks for itself in many ways, and they've already begun to informally engage in citizen advocates in DEQ, for instance, with this. The revenue corridors in terms of intergovernmental transfers for a board like this are rich out of Region 10 of the EPA, and I've worked with them for over a decade. And so if we can be allowed to accept the money, we can find the money. And there were, it was a different issue then, and many groups did not like perhaps a collaboration of industry and community without always an environmental litigation perspective on it. And that may have been my speculation. But I think we've gone past that. I think one of the fine examples of that is Jerry Sunvall, who was on the Environmental Justice Advisory Board. My spouse, Professor of Law Robin Morris Collin, was on their founding board of directors. Many long meetings late at night with nobody getting paid anything. And showing up to do this, and they've done well and done good. One of the mottos of environmental justice is we speak for ourselves. Communities speak for themselves. Oak Ridge speaks for itself. Every community speaks for itself. so I'm not going to speak for Ms. Sundahl.
Oh, thank you. My name is Jerry Sundahl. I'm a resident of Northeast Portland. I've been there for approximately 15 years. I'm a member of the Klamath Tribe. I served on the Governor's Task Force for the I-5 Partnership, and I'm currently serving on the Columbia River Crossing Task Force. We run a nonprofit community-based organization, which is about residents specifically only in North and Northeast Portland, although environmental justice reaches way further out than that, into tribes. It's urban, it's rural, it's anywhere where folks are poor or people of color, where they have more than their fair share of toxins that they're being exposed to. Portland, being the largest urban center in the state, is of course the most toxic. We have 16 hazardous air pollutants, anywhere from 10 to 785.89.5 times over the benchmark. Cancer benchmarks, meaning one in a million is an acceptable risk. We're looking at diesel particulate in our community 789.5 times over that. And we believe that it takes a collaboration between agencies and community, that that's the healthiest way to go, that that's the way we all win, because we're all breathing the same air. So we've been working for the last 5 years. Well, before that, we worked on brownfields, and there were issues. There are issues being the only brown person around a table, to be invited into a process because you're that brown person, not for any other reason. There are issues with being marginalized. But what we know is that our truth is as valuable as anyone else's truth. And it took me a long time to learn that, because I used to think everyone else was the expert except me. And the reality is, I'm the one who's breathing the air. I'm the one who's watching folks suffer in our community. And that we can empower ourselves to give the opinions that we need to. When we talked to the elders in our community, the environmental justice issues that came in had to do with promises made to people, you know, when Memorial Coliseum went in, when Emmanuel Hospital went in, that weren't kept. They weren't kept for the community, which causes mistrust in government, which breaks down the whole system. What we're looking at doing is repairing that mistrust and working with folks, and it hasn't been easy. In 2000, we initiated a lawsuit against a corporation for violation of the Clean Air Act. And the Department of Environmental Quality pulled me aside, because we were starting to have a relationship then, and told me, we don't have the money for Environmental Justice Department. Because I responded to him, I said, the community came out to your public hearing, and they asked all these questions, and it never got answered. None of them got answered. And so the community came to EJAG and said, this is an environmental justice issue. You need to deal with it. So we went and had a meeting with DEQ, and at the time they told us that we don't have the money for an environmental justice department. And that is a genuine missing of the whole point. It's about institutionalizing new principles into your life. It's about doing things in a better, smarter way. It's not about having someone sitting in a cubicle being the EJ person, you know, with all the EJ answers, and we send everyone to the EJ person. When we filed the lawsuit, DEQ sent us a letter saying they thought we were wrong. And I didn't have the understanding that I do now about why they thought we were wrong. That caused a communication breakdown between us for 3 years while the lawsuit went on. Eventually, we went into mediation with a federal court judge, and we came out with a settlement that was satisfactory to everyone. At that time, DEQ came back to us, and we came back to DEQ and said, you know, we know that you are a vital part of the decision-making process. We want you to recognize that we, too, are a vital part of that decision-making process. And because of that, now, last year, we received a $100,000 grant from the EPA to work collaboratively with DEQ, the Department of Transportation, and the Port of Portland. We're bringing in new members all the time, because we see the importance of not excluding anybody from this decision-making process. If you don't know my life and you're sitting at a table making decisions about me, you may not know that in our community there's a 14% asthma rate. But yet in Hillsborough, it's a 4.9% asthma rate. And in Southeast Portland, it's a 5% asthma rate. You may not know these things because I'm not at the table, or someone like me is not at the table telling you this information. So I can't blame you for making the decisions you make, but I'm just going to continue to suffer. That's the importance of environmental justice in a nutshell. Thank you.
Well, questions?
I just want to thank you for your testimony. I think it's a very important bill. I mean, the idea of shifting our toxins and the consequences of pollution onto those who have less power and less ability to speak for themselves is something that we've got to resist. I mean, we've been doing that for a long time, and this is a good response to that. Senator Shields, did you have something?
No, just thank
okay.
you very much.
Okay. Senator Byrd? Okay. Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
I appreciate it. Let's see, two more witnesses on this bill, Gail Shibley and Matt Blevins. You don't need to come up?
Well,
okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a delight to be here today. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I am the administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems for the state of Oregon. A piece of what used to be called and is often still known as the Oregon Health Division. First, I just want to say, on both a personal as well as a professional level, I just want to recognize and acknowledge my respect for Senator Gordley's leadership and championship on this issue. I happen to know from a firsthand basis some of what her long tenure in this very important area has involved. I just want to offer a few comments within the overall context just of public health, since that's my piece of, that's the keyhole that I'm peeking through of this much larger issue. And within public health, we view this in the overall context of population-based public health. We are extremely troubled by and focused on relieving the health disparities among various categories of citizens, residents in this country. For example, various research studies illuminate the fact that the infant mortality rate for black babies remains nearly 2.5 times higher than for whites. The life expectancy for black men and women in the United States remains at nearly one decade fewer years of life than those compared to white citizens. Meanwhile, diabetes disease strikes more than 30% higher among Native Americans and Hispanics than among whites. Now, clearly, these are very complex and complicated factors that result in statistics like that. The real issue, again, from a public health standpoint, is that we have a lot more questions than we have answers, and we certainly have a lot more questions than we have funding dollars to try to do the research and put this together. The concern, the issue, certainly is a bipartisan, multipartisan. This knows no, this does not subscribe to any particular allegiance. On the national level, folks like U.S. Senator Bill Frist, Senator Ed Kennedy, former Surgeon General Dr. David Satcher, the Institute of Medicine, the President of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, the California Endowment, the chairman of Aetna Insurance have all written about, talked about, and highlighted this issue of health disparity. Environmental justice is one piece of that, and I just want to point out that again, the Department of Human Services understanding and analysis of this bill would with general funds provide us with 1.0 FTE, we estimate, of a natural resource specialist, somewhere around $150,000 per biennium. That's not in the governor's recommended budget, and so again, as I stated before, we are and must be officially neutral because of that. We certainly couldn't be more supportive and of like concern on the issue and the concept
just
and
one,
the focus.
One more minute, please, just
sure.
to wrap up here.
Just that I just want to point out that during the last session of the legislature, we lost all general fund for environmental toxicology within public health. We are totally driven by fee-for-service and federal dollars and grants. And so there is no general fund that we have to try to switch around to provide the kind of resource that I think this bill calls for.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Blevins.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matt Blevins. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC strongly supports this bill, and I won't elaborate too much on my testimony that I've handed out, but basically we just want to again make the point that a number of the previous speakers have made, that again there's ongoing evidence that pollution and poverty go hand in hand both in Oregon and nationally. Research shows that low-income communities and people of color bear the greatest burden of this nation's environmental hazards. They're not abstract issues. The work that we've done in North and Northeast Portland in particular have identified some of the concerns at the local level. In Multnomah County, African American and Latino children are three times more likely than their white counterparts to have unsafe levels of lead in their blood. Low income and people of color are primarily at risk of exposure to health threats associated with fish contaminated by toxic chemicals because they're unaware of the risks or lack alternatives. And according to a study published in Environmental Health Perspectives, African Americans are two times as likely as whites to live within 1 mile of a toxics release inventory site. So there's clearly some issues that we need to address. We need better information, and we believe that this will help us go in this direction. And we also think that this is a good bill because looking at this is not just a one-time effort. This will institutionalize this work and make sure that we're continuing to look at this in the long term. So with that, I'll take questions.
Thank you very much. Anything? All right. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 542, and I want to put the committee in recess just for 5 minutes, so let's just go into recess.
Senate Committee on the Environment.
Hello.
Thank you, Senator Shields. We'll bring back to order the Senate Committee on Environment and Land Use. Just as an announcement, committee tomorrow, we have our 7 a.m. hearing up in room 343. You're all invited to come if you'd like. And the Senate Bill 542 that we just heard the public hearing on, we will move that schedule over till tomorrow. So I need to make that announcement. And let's open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 82. Director Shetterly. Is it Director? Okay.
Director. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I appreciate the time that you have extended for the hearing on this bill today. I also appreciate the fact that it is not tomorrow morning at 7. I will be brief.
It almost was.
I know. That's why I wanted to extend my thanks for that. I will be brief in my remarks. I know we have several other witnesses that have signed up to testify, some of whom have traveled a pretty good distance to get here. So I will just introduce this as quickly as I can. I'd be happy to make myself available for your questions, and I will stay to the end of the hearing if you have any follow-up questions after the other witnesses testify. Briefly, Senate Bill 82 represents a charge that the governor gave to me when he asked me just over a year ago to take on the directorship of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And this is the opportunity to enter into a comprehensive review of the land use planning system, that is to put the entire system on the table and undertake a review of the system from top to bottom, something that we have done on a piecemeal basis but not comprehensively over the past 32 years of the land use planning program. When the program was established, if you think back to how it got started, we had the passage of Senate Bill 100, and following that was a statewide series of meetings that involved, I'm told, more than 10,000 Oregonians in this process of creating the statewide land use planning goals. They were bold and they were visionary and they were something entirely new. And you had a substantial element of public support and buy-in and engagement in that process, and so engagement with the program. Over the past 30 years, and I'm reflecting here something both in terms of my observation as a someone who has been through the 30 years, but also served in the legislature, and now for the last year and some has traveled the state meeting with people who are working in this program, typically our local land use partners. Over the past 30 years, since the program really was established, you've gone from this visionary program that was really directed to goals and to a sense of what we wanted to be and to become in this state. And over time, with the legislature meeting every 2 years, adopting statutes and amending statutes, when you have LCDC enacting new goals and amendments to goals, you have the department's implementation of that, and then you have decisions out of the courts and out of the Land Use Board of Appeals interpreting and reinterpreting and implementing those goals and statutes and administrative rules. There has been an accretion of regulation on the system that for many people now has obscured the vision that really established the system in the first place. And what you know now for most Oregonians is that the system is regulatory, and it's as much about what you can't do as it is about why we do land use planning and why we have a program in the first place. Senate Bill 82 gets us back to a public process that engages Oregonians or provides the mechanism to engage Oregonians statewide, much the same as they were engaged in the beginning, but for the purpose of not only reconnecting Oregonians to the planning program, but also asking those hard questions, have we gotten to where we set out to get with our land use program? If we have not, where did we make those turns that we did not intend? What do we need to do to put ourselves back on course, and how can we better change what the program is and does to reflect our values as a society today, 32 years now after the establishment of the program? Would a system today, if we were creating it from scratch, better reflect the connection between land use planning and economic development? Would we recognize better the regionalization, regional interests in the program that are there, although not so transparently in the program? Do we need to affirm our commitment to support our agricultural and timber industries in this state as an integral part of the economy of Oregon for now and the future. And we also have issues regarding urban growth boundaries, the interface between urban growth boundaries and rural lands, all of these issues that we need to engage Oregonians in with the task force that is provided for in this bill strongly supported. I just want to say in closing a couple of things. I appreciate Jim Myron here from the governor's office indicating the governor's strong support for this. The fiscal impact of this bill has been incorporated in the governor's recommended budget. I think that's an expression of the extent of his support, so it is in the governor's recommended budget. You will be hearing some other interests today speaking in favor of the bill. I just want to pick out a couple that I'm not sure are represented today, but that you ought to be aware of to show a sense of the extent of support for this. The Oregon Business Summit, the group that meets every year up in Portland at the Convention Center. Last December, when they met and established the goals for economic development and land use, put the review of Oregon's land use planning program as their first priority in terms of their agenda for land use and economic development. Also, this bill has been is supported by the Community Development Forum, which represents counties, cities, the ports, special districts, as well as state agencies, and you'll hear from others who support it today. I believe in this bill. I have written testimony that underscores comments that are in addition to what I have given you just now. We also have Dash 1 amendments that we have discussed with other interests in this group that we also support. They're not particularly substantive. They reorder some of the language in the bill to put in its purpose statement a review of the effectiveness of the land use planning program in meeting current and future needs of Oregonians to make sure that that is elevated as a central and primary purpose, along with the other purposes that are already reflected in the bill. And it does provide for the provision by the task force to the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House of a work plan within 3 months after the creation of the task force to make sure that this group gets underway in a focused and very concerted sort of way. I think that's all I'll say in my comments on the bill now, unless you have any questions, but again, I will make myself available to answer questions after.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Let's bring up the ag folks. Rick Gustafson, Ken Bailey, Tom Bedell. And one other person.
Oh, he's here. Okay, Rick. Oh, he's got the copies.
Who wants to go first? You win.
I drew the short straw.
Okay.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Rick Gustafson. I'm a member of the State Board of Agriculture. I'm here with Ken Bailey, Tom Bedell, and Bernie Faber. Bernie is the current chair of the State Board of Agriculture, and we've had quite a bit of discussion. I've offered the written testimony to you with regard to our resolution and our position. Namely, our strong support for this bill and the comprehensive view of land use. Agriculture is very important in this state, and we believe very strongly that the urban growth boundaries and the exclusive farm use zones have been critical in assuring the long-term success of agriculture in the state, constituting about 9.5% of the gross state product of the state of Oregon. We're anxious to see this proceed and provide for this comprehensive review, and we would respectfully request that the role of agriculture through the board and the State Department of Agriculture be recognized and encouraged to be a direct part of this comprehensive review with the department.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Chairman Ringo and committee, my name is Ken Bailey. I'm a Cherry Gore from the Dalles. I'm vice chairman of the Board of Agriculture. I've been involved in the land use planning processes a little over 30 years from when this first began on a statewide basis. I think this effort of reviewing the, where we are in the land use issues, I think, is probably past due, but we probably weren't prepared to really commit to doing it until maybe Measure 37 passed.
Right.
I think with the complications that we're seeing as implementing 37 and some of the corrective actions I've seen trying to be put forward to help with Measure 37, I think is actually creating more issues that we probably ought to step back and take a better look at where we are and where we want to go and get a real better feel for where the people of the state of Oregon really want to be on land use and how it relates to the compensation and land use regulations and all these things put together. We have not been able to do that. Politically, we haven't been able to get together. Now, I think maybe is the time that we might be willing to sit down and try to hammer some of these out on a realistic basis rather than argue about it and get ourselves into the mess we have been creating for ourselves now. And as Rick pointed out, I think the Board of Agriculture strongly recommends that the board and the department be actively involved and a direct participant in the activities. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Folks, I'm Tom Bedell, also a member of the board, and I certainly agree with our testimony on this and won't add too much to the what you have written here, except to say that the land use planning efforts in this state, I think, are very, very good, even though there are some things that need to be reviewed and so on. All we have to do is go elsewhere. Other states, whether it's Idaho or whether it's Colorado and now Montana, to see what local, completely local jurisdictions do. And even though that's a democratic way to go about things, there's such a disconnect between the kinds of protections and so on. And standardization is sometimes something that a lot of us don't like. But some standardization helps us, I believe, as a society. And so we are due for a review on this, and I certainly support it as a member of the board and also as an individual.
Yes, Chair Ringo and committee. I'm Bernie Faber, Chair of the Board of Ag. I'm not going to add much to this, but to say that I've felt for some time that it was very important for us to get involved in these sort of situations. We put together this committee to work on land use, and I think they're doing a great job, and we're going to be more involved in this way of facilitating the board in different ways of working with other people to make sure that the land use things are done hopefully in the best interest of everybody. Thank you.
Do you questions? I guess I have one. You're asking that the board be, what were your words? Anyway, you said it, Rick. Are you asking that an amendment be drafted to specifically mention the Board of Agriculture and the Department of Agriculture be a part of this task force?
Senator Beyer, we have asked that we definitely be assured of being involved. I don't know if it requires an amendment as much as in the committee report and the recognition as the 30-year, if their 30-year review moves forward, that there's a clear understanding that the board and the department would be directly involved. We had a very good experience in the last year, 2 years, with Metro's process for considering urban growth boundary additions, as they're starting to recognize that they're stepping into exclusive farm use zones when they're talking about adding land to the urban growth boundaries. And in that process, the department was directly involved. The board reviewed the reports and the work that was done. We were very impressed with that. And it's something that often, as you look at urban growth boundary changes, you forget that the other side of the boundary is the as important operating farms. We thought we were very impressed with that process and would like to see a similar process with the 30-year review.
So just to be clear, you think as long as it's mentioned somewhere in a staff measure summary or mm-hmm. something like that, the Board of Agriculture is asked to be included, and you don't need an amendment to be named part of the bill?
That's correct. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Elon Hassan and Art Schlack, please.
And also wanted to mention my goal is to adjourn this hearing at 5 o'clock, so keep that in mind as you testify.
Thank you, Chair Ringo, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan, the legislative director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thousand Friends of Oregon supports this bill. We think it's the right bill and the right time for the bill, and we encourage to see its passage. And that's it.
Thank you.
Chair Ringo and members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. The Association of Oregon Counties supports passage of Senate Bill 82. I will note, though, for the record, that the counties have expressed a couple of concerns. One has to do with the composition of the committee. If you can imagine looking at the statewide planning program and envision potentially not a representative of counties or cities on the committee, I think it would be hard to envision that. So at this point, we have to take... be assured, looking at the Senate President, the Speaker, and the Governor, that local government, since we are and have been a partner in the land use planning program, be confident that they will choose representatives of local government to be part of the committee at this point. The other concern that some of our commissioners and judges have expressed is the time frame for this endeavor, thinking it's a little too long. However, I would note that I think it's going to take a while to establish the committee to get the three individuals to support unanimously the appointees, and so we're not as concerned with the time frame, but certainly 4 years should be the outside, and it shouldn't drag on beyond that length, that period of time. And with that, those comments, Mr. Chair, the Association supports passage of Senate Bill 82.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's bring the planners up here, Dr. Noah Toulon and Reeve Hinnian.
Mr. Chairman, there are two of us here. Reeve Hinnian will speak after my presentation. I am Noah Toulon, Dean Emeritus of Portland State University's College of Urban and Public Affairs, but I'm not here today representing the university. I have been a practicing planner for more than 50 years and a member of the American Planning Association and its predecessor since 1958. I'm a charter member of the American Institute of Certified Planners and one of the 12 Oregon members of its College of Fellows. I'm not an official spokesman for any of these three groups, but I know that the views I'm expressing here today reflect the prevailing thought among their members. 5 years ago, I chaired an APA committee charged with reviewing the record of our nationally and internationally recognized statewide land use planning program. The Committee on the Oregon Planning Experience, or COPE, as it became known, was composed of individuals who are well informed about the program, including some who were directly involved in its creation and early administration. We spent close to 18 months reviewing documents, interviewing individuals familiar with the program, and conducting outreach sessions and in-depth discussions with 55 diverse individuals from all regions of the state. These included supporters as well as critics of the program. As identified by the committee, the challenges facing the program could be attributed to the ways it was being implemented and not from its basic objectives. Everybody we talked to, including those who identified themselves as being very critical, acknowledged the program's central role in enhancing our livability and our economic well-being. But the challenges are serious enough, and they stem from a perception of unfairness and inequity, the need for articulation of a vision, and the need for a flexible approach that accommodates local and regional differences. To put it briefly, the committee concluded that changing realities make it imperative that we re-examine the program. These realities stem from changes in demography, economic base, and the primary purpose of the program. We recognize that the need exists for a concerted effort to re-engage Oregonians in a conversation about the future of their state and their communities and the role that planning plays in shaping and securing their goals and aspirations. We recognize that planning is about shared vision, but it is also about balance, a balance between cost and benefit, and between the interests of the individual and the interests of the community. We are fortunate to live in a state greatly admired for its courage in making the tough decisions to manage growth in a way that enhances its livability and economic vitality. We are a state that is growing because people find it a good place to live and invest in. There is nothing wrong with growth if managed properly. Planning is never about controlling growth. It is about managing and directing it to where it does the greater good. This is what our vision should be about, and this is the most likely outcome if the bill in front of you today is approved. It will launch a process that could implement many of the suggestions presented in the COP report. It is time for us to put in place the means by which we can re-engage ourselves as well as the public in developing a vision and a direction. We need to bring back the energy and excitement that was there when Senate Bill 100 was adopted. For us not to do so is to admit that the past 30 years were a failure. I cannot accept that. Ballot Measure 37 is not the end of the world. It is perhaps a wake-up call that needs to be taken seriously by the proposed task force. I believe the bill as it stands is a step in the right direction. We need to protect and enhance our planning program, and your bill will do so. It is a balanced bill, and I urge you to approve it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Chairman Ringo, members of the committee. My name is Reeve Henyon. I'm chairman of the Jackson County Planning Commission and a member of the executive board of the Oregon chapter of APA. I'll be very briefly, but I'm here for two reasons today. First of all, as a member of the executive board, I just want to assure you that our the 925 members of the Oregon APA, the SB 82 is our top legislative priority this year. You have before us a sheet listing our legislative priorities, and included in number one, the way we think we should go about the improvements in our system, is to have this review. Secondly, I'm here from Jackson County just to let you know that this is by no means a Willamette Valley issue, that certainly those of us from other parts of the state are very interested in this review. I personally have been involved in various efforts to try and get some kind of review since it was a 25-year review 7 years ago, and I'm hopeful that this time we'll finally be able to accomplish something. Because I'd been involved in 7 years, it long preceded Measure 37. And I would just say that with Measure 37, I see that as an opportunity. It's an opportunity for two reasons. Number one, because it has gotten the attention of Oregonians in land use to a greater extent than they have been for many, many years. Secondly, Oregonians made some kind of a statement when they voted for Measure 37. I don't think any of us know exactly what it was, except it had something to do with fairness, and this review would be a great chance to find out. So I urge you to pass and support this bill. I think it's a great idea for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I had a question maybe for you, Stephen Kafori. Are these amendments offered by you?
Mr. Chair, these amendments are not offered by me. These amendments are offered by LCDC, but they are a result of a group of people, including myself, who came together to produce.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I make just one quick comment?
Yeah, sure.
And that is that there is a budget, as you notice in this bill, but I wanted to let you know that the National American Planning Association and our local chapter are both willing and interested in getting national grant money. We think we have access to some money that will supplement this so that we can do this job the way it needs to be done in terms of serious outreach to all the communities of the state, and not by just a select few people who are, you know, have an axe to grind. We want to be truly representative of the view of Oregon.
Okay. Thank you very much, committee. All right. I appreciate your testimony. Thanks for coming up from Jackson County.
Thank you.
Liz Frankel, Peggy Lynch.
Liz Frankel, League of Women Voters. We're passing out the written testimony. I do want to add that in addition to what people have talked about, the whole implication of Measure 37 and legislative action has the potential for leading to a great deal of piecemeal corrections or changes or reforms or additions. And I want to point out that there is a complication here, and one of the reasons that the League supports this bill as radically as they do is that in the coastal regions, in the coastal states, and the ports along the state, they get a lot of money, federal money, for planning, for economics, for all kinds of things. This is based upon the fact that we have a coastal management program that is approved by the feds. We run a very severe risk with the little piecemeal approach, and I'm just using this as an example, of not looking at the entire system and the way in which it works together. Because the foundation for that coastal management program is half of that. We get about $2.1 million that comes in. Half of that goes directly to local government. That's a big infusion. But if we riddle some of the coastal management program, which is based upon our statewide land use planning, we run a severe risk of losing that program. Let's try to keep it together. This is one way to do it, and I can't think of another. I do not see the legislature being able to pull this all together in the few months that we have left. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peggy Lynch. I'm a native Oregonian with relatives all over this state. My stepfather was a log truck driver, and so the timber industry was important to my youth. My first year of college was paid for by selling a registered Angus and calf, so the agriculture industry is also important to me. And I say that because oftentimes those are the two things that are most pointed out when we talk about Oregon's land use program. But I will tell you that I also lived in Washington County, and I remember when Intel expanded its plants from its original small Aloha facility, and one of the reasons, besides the fact that we had an abundance of clean water and we had Tektronix workers that were already trained, was the fact that they had certainty in the land use program, and they knew that they did not have to fight about the industrial land, and they could go ahead and build their industrial plants. I've been involved in land use planning for 30 plus years. I helped write the first community plan in Washington County. Committees of business people and residents and landowners from around the area met, frankly, on my dining room table when we first started doing this. So this program has really been all about citizen involvement and land use and connecting community and citizens together in a proper manner. I encourage your support of this particular Senate bill approach to re-engaging Oregonians in the land use program. It is critical to our health, our community health, our economic health, and frankly, it is what Oregon is all about.
Thank you very much, committee. Appreciate that. Pat Zimmerman.
Chairman Ringo, excuse me, members of the committee, my name is Pat Zimmerman. I live around Scappoose. I'm chair of the Citizens Involvement Advisory Committee. It's an 8-member committee appointed by Land Conservation and Development Commission to represent the interests of citizens in Oregon's land use planning, specifically Goal 1, citizen involvement. You should have received email from a couple of other members of our committee, Ian Maitland and Sue Johnson. We very strongly support Senate Bill 82. We also believe that Measure 37 shows that we have a great deal of work left to do in terms of citizen involvement. I support the bill for all the reasons you've already heard. There's no need to repeat them. One point. Although you, as members of this committee, aren't going to be appointing the people on the committee, I believe you'll have an influence. We asked that you use what influence you have to ensure that citizens are represented on this committee. It is very important that the citizens of the state get reconnected with the positive things about their land use planning committee, land use planning program. One example, I was recently appointed as a citizen representative to a Goal 14 work group. 21 members of the committee. I was the sole person on the committee that did not earn either all or a substantial part of her or his living from professional participation in the land use system. That is not the kind of group that is going to be able to help us reconnect with the citizens of Oregon. We ask that you strongly recommend that at least, I'll say two, maybe three, just ordinary citizens who are not charged with a particular point of view on the land use program, but rather look at their communities and look at the effect of this whole thing on their communities, be members of the 10-member committee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have Randy Tucker and Jim Myron. Did you want to testify? Mike Carrier's not here, is he? Okay. Well, Randy, you're clean. Anybody going to testify against this bill? Mm-hmm. Only kidding.
I thought you were going to ask if anyone was going to testify against me. Mr. Chair.
Oh, you, why don't you come on up, too, John?
Sorry.
Can we get you on my list here?
And there he is. No. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager from Metro. As you may know, Metro was created by the citizens of the region, and then in 1992, a charter adopted that makes our primary mission the management of the growth of the metropolitan region. We are embarking, the Metro Council is embarking on its own long-term review big picture review of the assumptions and the processes that we use in order to carry out that mission. And so in light of that effort that we're undertaking, it's with great enthusiasm, the Council supports similar or much bigger, actually, effort at the state level. The Council has gone on record as making the adoption of Senate Bill 82, one of its top priorities this session, and is urging the creation of a task force to carry out a review that is comprehensive, balanced, fact-based, and solution-oriented. And we would welcome the opportunity to participate actively in that process. There are a lot of issues that are very complicated and interconnected that it's hard to grapple with in the context of a legislative session. In the metro area, we're dealing with the interplay between the hierarchy that places farmland at the top of the list for protection or when UGBs are expanded, the 20-year residential land supply requirement. We've got annexation issues, funding for the development of infrastructure and planning and service delivery to areas that are newly urbanizing, that are brought into the UGB, etc. And the kind of big picture, long-term approach that is called for in Senate Bill 82 can create a good setting for floating of ideas that are sort of outside the box, that's much safer than what often we find in the legislative session. Can create the space, the time for research-oriented and deeply fact-based approach to looking at the program. So with that, we support Senate Bill 82.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Chandler.
Senator Ingle, members of the committee, John Chandler, the Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of Senate Bill 82. I see only have 5 minutes left, so I'll have to give you the condensed version of my stump speech on Oregon land use planning. Mars or Venus is the subject. I do want to respond to a couple of things you've heard today. This was a bill we brought forward last session along with a group of people. It didn't quite pass, but did start a very good conversation. And one of the things that we talked about last session, though, has been mentioned here today, is the makeup of this committee. I'd like to go, Ms. Zimmerman, one more than just two or three citizens. I think this needs to be made up of people who aren't necessarily invested in the land use system. My belief, having been a combatant in the land use wars for many years, a good chunk of the problems we have come from those who are invested in the land use system. And what I believe has happened in this state is we've lost track of what it is we're doing and why we're doing it, particularly the why. We tend to do a lot of things reflexively because we do them. And if this committee can be made up of nothing else, the reason it's structured with unanimous consent of the governor, the speaker, and the president, is an attempt to get folks who are first and foremost care about this state, who understand this state, who want this state to go forward and plan for the next 30 years and not fight the wars of the last 30 years. Last session, Bob Stacey and I sat up at the witness stand. I don't know if I can speak for Bob or not. I will speak for myself. The point we made was if asked to serve on this committee, I will not do so. I think it's important that this be made up of people who aren't necessarily invested with a particular outcome or a particular agenda or a particular interest or a particular anything, but simply want to bring their own, their heart and their intellect and their vision to this process. If it happens to be 10 people, all of whom know the predetermined outcome, it will fail. It'll be a waste of time plus the $900,000 budgeted for it. If we get the right people on this, we will have a system we can be proud of again. With that, I'll conclude and urge your support.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you. Director Shetterly, could you just come back up for 1 second, please?
I see right there.
I agree with John.
You agree with John. Okay. What do you want us to do? Do you want us to adopt the dash ones? We didn't really talk about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We would ask you to adopt the dash ones. Again, they don't add anything substantive to the bill. I think the concern was that in the original draft, yeah, if you looked down on it's the language that's deleted, lines 18 and 19 of page 1. That kind of buries what is a critical element of the purpose to assess the effectiveness of Oregon's land use planning program in meeting current and future needs of Oregonians in all parts of the state. In our discussions with Mr. Kafoury and Mr. Chandler and Mr. Stacey was in the room, and I think there were a few others represented as well, the consensus was that it was appropriate that that be moved up to subsection 2 of section 1, which is really where the purposes of this task force are stated. So that language was unburied from a process subsection to really the purpose subsection. And then there was the addition also on lines 13 through 19 of the Dash 1 Amendment to make clear that within 3 months of appointment, the task force would report to the governor, the speaker, and the Senate president with a work plan to help ensure that this gets off to a quick start. And those are the two elements of the Dash 1 Amendments. And I do believe that from the group that represents the consensus that brought the bill forward, these Dash 1 Amendments are supported as well.
And what about the fiscal?
$900,000 that represents staff positions to support the work of the task force that's devoted to the task force, as well as personal service contracts to retain experts not on staff, such as for research and polling and focus groups and doing the kind of in the community work that this effort is going to take in order to be successful. Again, the bill is in the governor's recommended budget. We will be having, assuming that it gets out of this committee and across the floor, we're prepared to have the conversation in detail on the fiscal and Ways and Means Subcommittee.
Okay.
But I'll be happy to answer any other specific questions you might have.
I think we would pass the bill out right now to Ways and Means if we had a committee.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll just do this tomorrow morning. So let me just make the announcement then that we will roll the schedule on Senate Bill 82 over till to the 7 a.m. hearing at March 18th. Nobody in this room needs to be there.
You don't have a notice problem with that, Mr. Chair?
No.
On the agenda? Okay.
I'm sorry, March 22nd. Okay. Yes, March 22nd. And my goal then is when I have a committee just to pass it out tomorrow morning.
All right.
So that closes the public hearing on Senate Bill 82, and this meeting is adjourned.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.